Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
From WBEZ Chicago, I'm Greta Johnson, and this is the Nerdette Book Club. It's just like a regular book club, except you don't have to share your snacks. It is the month of January in the year 2023, and our book this month is Kevin Wilson's delightful novel, Now Is Not the Time to Panic. It's about Frankie, who is an adult when the story starts, but it's really about one summer when she's a teenager. She's bored and lonely until she meets Zeke, who's another weird teenager in their tiny Tennessee town. And they end up creating a very strange poster and make a zillion photocopies of it with a stolen copy machine hidden in Frankie's garage. They put it all over town, and this weird, impulsive poster ends up totally changing the world. The phrase in the poster is used in SNL skits. It's a part of Pulitzer winning reporting, even social uprisings. That is all I am going to say for now, but this is your spoiler warning. If you have not read this book and you do not want to know what happens, this is not the conversation for you. You should go listen to our spoiler free interview with author Kevin Wilson that is in the feed now. If you haven't read the book and you do want to know what happens, or if you have read the book and you already know what happens, we are very glad to have you. Our panelists this time around are two of my favorites. We have Angie Kim. She's the author of the novel Miracle Creek, and her next novel, Happiness Falls, is coming out in September. Angie, welcome back to the book club.
I'm so excited.
It's perfect. We also have here Gwen Kirby, whose short story collection, Shit Cassandra Saw, was one of my favorite books last year. Gwen, hello.
Hello. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Greta.
Oh my gosh, so excited to have you. Full disclosure, you are, in fact, friends with Kevin in real life, which means I'm very jealous.
Yes, I am, but I will let my harsh critique of how much I love this book just flow anyway.
Amazing. I love it. I love harsh critiquing of friends.
Okay, so I mentioned the phrase that's on the poster. I think that's where we should begin. Yes. We actually have Kevin saying it. I asked him to recite it when I interviewed him earlier this month. Here it is.
The Edge is a shanty town filled with gold seekers. We are fugitives, and the law is skinny with hunger for us.
Ugh, so beautiful, oh, so evocative.
So cool.
Angie, what do you think it means? I mean, in some ways it's so specific and yet completely vague at the same time, which means I think so many, you know, you can read into it so many different ways. What does it evoke for you?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's, to me, because it came at the end of Frankie and Zeke talking about art and, you know, and her saying like, what do you want me to write? And Zeke is going, just write something, write something. And she's like, I can't just write something. My writing doesn't work that way. And so she was thinking about, you know, like all the things that she was thinking, like her fucked up dad. And I think it sort of like means that to me that, you know, she's really, they're kind of alone, and they're sort of lonely in this way, but yet completely like seen by everyone. They're fighting against the world the way that you feel when you're 16, you know? So it like captures that feeling for me.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way of putting it. What do you think, Gwen?
I was so taken in by this phrase because I felt like at once I could read so much into it, you know, being like, what is like the edge? The edge is this place where we make art. And then the gold seekers made me think of like capitalism and what does it mean to be a kid and all of this stuff. And yet at the same time, there's just such a pleasurable, incantatory quality to it where it doesn't need to mean anything at all to feel powerful. Yeah. And so I sort of loved that in it where I felt like I could both overread it and not read it whatsoever and still feel kind of fulfilled by it.
Yeah.
Completely.
Such a good way of putting it, too. So, Gwen, I mean, we talked to Kevin about how this is a phrase that he says multiple times a day to himself every day and has for a very long time. Were you familiar with it before this book came out?
No, I had no idea. I actually did not know about the origin of this phrase until listening to your interview with Kevin.
Oh, funny.
And I was so touched and fascinated by it because I listened to this book on audiobook. I had read it once, but I wanted to get it back. And it was a wonderful audiobook. And I was listening to that phrase and I was just thinking like, my gosh, how did Kevin come up with that? Mm-hmm. And then to hear that it was actually a friend of his from sort of a much earlier time in his own life who had come up to it. I just felt like it reinforced the magic around it somehow that not even the author had come up with it, that like it preceded the book itself.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you use the word magic because that was something else I talked to Kevin about, but I did think was really interesting with this one because in a lot of ways, this is his least magical novel, but there was still so much magic kind of inferred.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the magic comes from something real that's happening with art, in the way that as a teenager, you hope that your art will sort of, transform the world. And somehow it has, in this way that unlike in, some of his previous books where you're kind of, into the fantasy world of it, this, you can see this happening. You know that shit like this can happen and has happened in some way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we got a bunch of listener voicemails this time around, which is very exciting.
Yay.
Let's take a listen to Annalisa from Bedford, Massachusetts.
I could feel what it felt like in Tennessee in the summertime with Kevin Wilson's writing. I could feel the heat, the oppressive humidity, the kind of unrealness of what that summer felt like. I also was really interested to hear how the phrase in the book was actually created by a friend of Kevin Wilson. And it is a phrase that evokes weirdness and uncomfortableness, but in a good way. And now I really want to see that poster. I kept wanting to turn the page and have a big picture of what the poster actually looked like. And now I want a t-shirt with it too.
I want to put out a challenge to Nerdette listeners to design the poster. Wouldn't that be fun?
I really, really want to see the poster so badly.
Right?
In fact, I feel like they should make a movie, like a limited series or something, or a movie or something of this right now. And that should be, and that should be the trailer, right? Like it should
yes.
be them making it. It would be, oh, and then the blood like going all over like stars. Oh, that would be so cool.
I also just love the phrase weirdness and uncomfortableness, but in a good way.
Yeah, very.
That could be the blurb for Kevin's whole canon of work, I think.
Right, right. Exactly.
Totally good. I bet he would love it.
Totally. Yeah.
Here's another voicemail. This one is from Jenna in Nashville.
This book made me laugh. It made me cry. It made me want some Pop-Tarts. And I thought it was a really tender look at loneliness and at connection. And I love the way that Kevin Wilson writes about misfits. Also, as a lifelong Tennessean, I just want to say that I'm really glad that Kevin Wilson writes about Tennessee.
So here's a question for both of you. The misfits thing, I think this is such a beautiful capturing of like how it feels to be a weird teenager. And I was talking to my mom about this because she read it recently. And she was like, Greta, I think it always feels weird. She was like, I think it's less about weirdness and more about just like the inherent weirdness of being a teenager at all. And I was curious what each of you thought about that.
That's such a great question, because I do think that the weirdness in this book could speak to anyone who was a teenager. I think there is something inherently weird about your body changing.
Right.
And the way that Kevin deals with kissing and sex in this felt so like unerotic in a way that actually felt so true to being like 15 or 16.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a special kind of weirdness that comes from being the kind of teenager who really doesn't fit in with the other teenagers. And that urge to make art or like make something that can express how disconnected you feel even from your peers, to me seems like something really important that Kevin is getting at. Like it is more than just the weirdness of being a teenager. It's the weirdness of being a teenager who doesn't even fit in with any other teenagers.
Yeah, no, I feel exactly the same way. And I think that's one of the reasons why it spoke to me so much. I started listening to it on January 1st. Hmm. And I just thought I would just like give myself a little treat for half an hour and, you know, start this book on the audiobook. And I just didn't get out of bed. I listened to it the entire day. I didn't even like get up and do stuff like while listening. I just like you could have sat there in bed. I know I could have, and I should have done that, especially, you know, like January 1st, like, oh, you know, exercise more or whatever. Something. No. And I think that, and I think it was even like the watermelon scene in the very beginning, you know, which is the first scene that we see of them. I was such a weird kid. And, you know, I came over from Korea. I didn't speak English and, you know, in middle school, and I was bullied and all that kind of stuff, and always like feeling left out. And in this pool where she has these triplet brothers.
The brothers were, like, were so funny.
The triplets. And, you know, and they're going around like stealing people's money while they're doing this weird, like greased up watermelon thing, polo. And, you know, and then seeing and then recognizing somebody else, like just one other person who you know that you can maybe be weird together with, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then her somehow like summoning up the $20 bribe for her brothers just so that they'll help him to win, so that they can actually be part of this weird thing that this town has. And, you know, and how they bond over that. I think it just, there is like a huge loneliness thing that it's not all teenagers, or at least it didn't seem that way to me anyway. And the fact that they can come together and collaborate and create something that like goes beyond them and actually fulfills their dream of what they like said that they wanted to do over the summer.
Yeah.
That just seems to me to be so powerful.
Let's listen to another voicemail. Here's Liz in Roseville, Minnesota. She's talking about weirdness a little bit too.
Hey, so that part about where Frankie talks about the books that she likes and the librarian and her mom, like reading every single Nancy Drew book, and then it goes to a different book and someone else gives her another book, but she never tells people about the books that she really likes, because everything that you like, what was it, can be like an intense obsession, but also a way to feel shame, right? Like, oh, that part that hit me, that piece of like, I wish I could have accepted my like weirdness and quirkiness earlier, because I think if we all could have done it growing up and younger, right? Like what full people and fuller people could we have become earlier?
In just a minute, more on Now Is Not the Time to Panic.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Gwen, you mentioned the awkwardness of their like sort of physical relationship, and it's something that I thought was really interesting. It rang true to me, but it also, you know, I mean, I think there could definitely be a version of this book where they were like actually more romantically involved with each other. And it was something I asked Kevin about when we had him on as like my spoilery question. And here's what he had to say.
They're friends, you know, and they're interested in each other, and they're mostly interested in each other because of what they see in the other that they can now do. You know, they can make art, they can do this stuff, but they do make out. They are attracted to each other, but they make out in a way where they just like press their mouths against each other for long periods of time. They don't want to actually touch, so their bodies don't touch. I don't know. A lot of times when I read like YA or books about teenagers, they're also weirdly confident in the amount of sex that they want to have. And when I was 15, and really and truly, like, reading Nancy Drew when I was 15, because I still love them, and I wanted no part of this stuff. Like, what a weird prude. How terrifying that all sounded. And I wanted to be a kid for as long as I could. And so I wanted to write a book about teenagers who, like, want things, like, they desire, but, like, the actuality of it is kind of gross to them. What do you do in the absence when you feel this intense desire for them? And it's like, well, let's do something. Let's make something. Let's connect in these other ways.
The way he says they make out, I just think is so good.
Oh, that's so hilarious. Because especially even their first kiss, you know, their first kiss is, was it actually on the Xerox machine when they were like making that copy of their face?
Yeah, it was.
Right. And so you're just like, okay. And she kisses him and like, but it's for the art. It's for, so to, cause she's curious to see, you know, how it's going to look. And he's like, well, why'd you do that? And she's like, I don't know. So hilarious.
It spoke to me so much. I just remember how much some of those milestones felt like burdens when I was a teenager. All you want to do is just get them behind you.
Oh my God. Right. I cried after my first kiss. I was like, that's it? That was gross. Here's another really nice voice memo we got from Maya.
One of the scenes that has kind of stuck in my brain really in a visceral way was the car crash scene. I thought that the way that he took us through Frankie's thought process was so moving, and how she addressed it with her mom when she woke up in the hospital. It was just handled with such delicacy and compassion that I thought was really beautiful. I also thought that Frankie's mom's portrayal in general felt really unique and lovely. The way that she kind of dealt with each of her children's various struggles and growing up, and I just thought that that was unique and something that I hadn't really seen in parents of teens being portrayed in different books.
I thought that was a great voice memo, partly because of the idea of, I forget exactly how she phrases it, but like the delicacy of the that intense scene. I think there is something about his writing that you get through the other books too, but especially in this one, where there is a tenderness, like you feel, as much as it is about isolation and loneliness and fear, you feel held throughout. It's like, that's the best way I could come up with putting it. You know what I mean, though?
Hmm.
I do. He's such a kind writer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like there's just so much empathy. I mean, even the only character in the whole book who comes close to being a villain is Zeke's dad. And even he is so redeemed by the end of the book. He handles the car crash so well. And I think part of that is his choice to use that retrospective narrator. Even though we are in that moment, and it's really visceral and it's really upsetting, we have that tiny bit of distance from us, as if, you know, she's saying like, but it was okay, you know, even though it's so horrible.
Right. So we kind of talked about this earlier, the fact that this takes place in the 90s. I think there's a really interesting nostalgia in this book, both for, I think, like childhood in general, but especially the fact that this is before tech exploded the way it did. You know, I mean, we even got a voicemail from someone that used the phrase the special time of photocopiers, you know, like it is a very specific era. And we got a couple calls about it. Let's listen to Robin.
This feels like one of a whole bunch of books that I've read lately that are written by authors who've got to be like the same age as me, reflecting on our adolescence right before smartphones and internet like took over the world, and this sort of analog vibe of our youth that I've been missing, and clearly the authors have too. So This Time Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow falls in that category too. And Now Is Not the Time to Panic, which like harkens back to this special time of photocopiers and like getting out into the world to spread your message instead of sitting on your couch to do it. It's just really nostalgic to remember a world that we engaged with that way.
I also love the phrase analog vibes.
I did too. Yes, I wrote that down too. I love that.
So yeah, do you think something like this could happen in the same way in 2023? Or is that just like, is the phrase a tweet that would have gone viral?
Yeah, I mean, what I love about it is that it did go viral. But it went viral in this almost like a slow car crash kind of viral. Mm. You know what I mean? Like instead of, like now it would be like somebody snaps it and, you know, posts it or puts it on Discord or whatever they do these days, like whatever people do, or TikTok. And then it would just like go all over or whatever. And then it would be over like really quickly, right? And having to just actually make photocopies and put them up physically around everywhere, that just to me was so amazing and something that would never happen now because it's so much easier just to like try to get an influencer to tweet it or something.
Right. Well, and am I misremembering or does she keep putting them around even when she's older, like in libraries?
She
and
does
stuff? Ugh, I love that.
Yeah, she never stops, which I love.
Yeah, that's so sweet.
And I love that her daughter is like the daughter had memorized it because she was like, Yeah, mom, you say it all the time. You say it all the time. How would I not know? Like, I live in this house.
Gwen, what struck you about the nostalgia piece?
I've spent a lot of time trying to decide, like, if this would have any chance to go viral now. I don't think so because I think there's something not grabby about it. It's like something that you sit in your town and you like stare at and you don't really think anything of it the first time you see it or even the second time you see it, but then like the fifth and the tenth time it like it's like a little worm that starts to get into you. And that's why it's so cool that it's this, you know, it's this really slow start that then really takes off in a way that I feel like if some kid made it and posted it on Instagram, you'd just be like, you know, scroll, and then you wouldn't have to see it again. You know, it would just be gone in the way that like that physical object of the poster. If I saw that every time I went into the Piggly Wiggly, I feel like I would start to be like, what the fuck is that? Like, and it would stay with me. And I remember that from being a teenager, you know, like, I mean, I did have AOL chat, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't anything like the world is now.
Well, and I think you're right, too, that like you if you could Google the phrase and figure out like, oh, it was some teenagers in Tennessee, you'd be like, OK, mystery solved, you know?
Yeah. It goes back to that word magic, right? Like the magic would be gone. You'd be able to say, well, that's what it is. That's where it's from. That's what it means. But like it resists all of those things. It sort of exists outside of time and place and provenance.
The magic of the analog vibes.
Yeah, love it.
So one thing that really struck me, and I'm not sure I don't think I'm like bothered by it in terms of my enjoyment of the book, but it is something I have found myself wondering a lot, which is the fact that Frankie didn't tell anyone that she was the one who made the poster, I think is a really interesting choice. And I think I get it, but I also just have such a hard time in some ways picturing the idea of experiencing this super formative event in your own personal life that also ends up impacting so many other people and not like bringing that up at a dinner party or something. You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah. But to me, that's the power of it, right? Mm. Is that it's almost like the power dissipates if you say it out loud. Like part of the power is that it's magical and mythical, and part of that power is that nobody knows who did it. So it's sort of like, you know, it's like what Gwen was saying just a minute ago about how if you know who it is, then all of a sudden it's just not that interesting anymore.
Yeah, I think too that I think Kevin does a good job making me believe that Frankie is the sort of person for whom a secret is really important. And I think the way that things end with Zeke also feels like a huge part of why I believe that she would never tell.
True.
Like, I think he did a pretty good job sort of like putting external forces on her, like these two deaths and Zeke's obvious terror and all of these things that you think like, like with her husband, that there was maybe this window for her to say something.
Yeah.
But like it's closed and it's become so huge in her own head.
Yeah.
That like she thinks it's like setting off a bomb, you know, just by the scene with her mom. Yeah. Where her mom is just like, oh, yeah, sweetie. Uh-huh. Like, I know. She's like, I know she's like, there's a huge Xerox machine in the garage, baby. Like, I'm not, you know. And look, I so agree with the lovely person who put that call in. The mom, I thought, was so well written.
Yeah.
And just really great.
Well, and like the perfect combination of like beleaguered and distant, but also still engaged and concerned. You know, I mean, especially like triplet boys. Can you imagine?
No, oh I cannot.
I could
imagine.
Not imagine.
I cannot imagine.
I refuse to imagine.
Yeah, no. I have three boys, but they're three boys throughout 7 years, and that was like a lot.
Yeah,
and so I cannot imagine. And I love how she talks about how her mom like kind of changed after the dad left, because she was like, well, it was like she was trying to control everything and make sure that nothing bad would happen. And then something bad happened. And then she was like, it's okay. It's okay. Like something bad happened and life did not fall apart. And that's kind of what happens with her too, you know, with the whole secret.
Totally. Well, and that's another instance, I think, of like, there is a version of that dynamic that is really unsafe and kind of scary. But this is like still, and it's definitely, you know, traumatic for Frankie to have gone through this and, you know, the fact that her dad just peaced out, and the fact that she's got this half sibling also named Francis. But even that, you know, again, with the safetiness of it all, like there's a delicacy even to that stuff, I think, you know.
You can just feel how loved she is.
Yes.
Which actually, for me, made me think a lot about, I don't know, maybe what it must be like being a parent reading the book, which Angie, you could speak to, but I cannot. But just, you know, knowing remembering all the secrets you kept when you were that age, and how much your parents know you and know what you're up to, and how much they don't know you and what you're up to. And what a strange moment that is when you're still living in your parents' home, but you have this life that's becoming totally yours. I don't know. I thought a lot about what that must feel like as a parent, in addition to having the memories of it as a kid.
Yeah, no. And I think that's why I keep on fixating on this moment of the mom going like, oh, sweetie, I knew all along. Of course it's you. Because, you know, that's what you think. Like when you're a teenager, you think that your parents don't understand you. You're right, like, I am so unique. I am so like strange and weird. And my parents were never like this. Nobody has felt like this ever before. Certainly not my parents, you know? And so you just think that. And then to find out later that this thing that you thought was a huge secret that your parents would like, it would kill them, it would crush them to find out. And then to find out that they knew all along. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's just so, it's such a, to me, it said so much about the book and her relationship with her, not only her mom, but, you know, with the whole town, you know, even, and also just the crush of finding out that Mr. Avery told her secret, like in some letter. That was like kind of crushing in the other way. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. But what was it? I can't remember exactly what he writes in the letter, but doesn't he kind of describe her very like he sees her in a way that it seems like most people don't in that town.
He does. He says that he thinks that she's a better artist than he's ever been. Yes. It's really beautiful. I wondered how he was going to pull that off and if there would be like a real feeling of betrayal, you know, like who finally let the secret go. And I didn't feel that. I think maybe this speaks a little bit to the analog vibes, but because it's in this like written letter between these two men, you know, it felt like a telling of the secret in the most private, I don't know, in the most private way you could tell a secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. All right. We have one more voicemail. It is from Allie.
I'm only 3/4 of the way through. Now is not the time to panic, but I'm really enjoying it so far, both as someone who lives in a small town an hour from Memphis and as a forever weird teen who found solace in the obsessions of Southern Gothic writers like Carson McCullers and Flannery O'Connor. I also keep thinking a lot about how this book resonates with some of our recent book club picks. The art partnership between Frankie and Zeke made me think of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, and the novel's overall interest in the power of art and the role that art plays in making change made me think of Our Missing Hearts, though perhaps here the change art brings isn't always good. Kevin Wilson definitely has his own take on artist obsessions, and I love how strange and dark it is.
Since those were a couple of titles mentioned in comparison, I would love to know what books each of you would recommend to someone who read this one and really liked it. It involves putting both of you on the spot. Angie, I'm going to start with you alphabetically.
So Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, which the, you know, this reader brought up, was the first thing that for me, just I think because of the collaborative nature of it, and also the nostalgia factor,
right.
Like both of those things together, like, and, you know, and also just the sort of will they, won't they kind of, you know, that vibe.
True.
But given that she brought that up, I was like thinking, like, what else?
Shit, what do I think of now?
No, actually, and this is a book that hasn't been released yet. It's coming in April.
Ooh.
It's Greek Lessons by Han Kang.
Cool.
The voice is nothing like Kevin Wilson's, but the reason I bring it up is because of this intense, you know, vibe of loneliness and two people who overcome like really strange things that are happening to sort of come together, and how the coming together, you know, enables you to find a connection. So it's about a woman who is losing her ability to speak. altogether, like a very strange, you know, bizarre situation. And then she's getting Greek lessons. She's Korean. This is in Seoul. And she is taking lessons on Greek by a man. And the man is losing his sight, and just the overcoming and connecting together. So it just it had that thematic mood, if you will, and the weirdness also made me think of that. But the voices aren't really anything alike. Just
interesting.
FYI.
No, that's great. That's a wonderful recommendation. It sounds really fascinating.
Very fascinating. Awesome.
Gwen, what do you think?
But there's a few books that came to mind. It's always so hard to pick. So I think one thing I love about Kevin's work is the weirdness.
Yes.
And one thing I love about being friends with Kevin is how much he loves weird things. And so there's a short novel that I know Kevin loves and I love too, called Mrs. Caliban by Rachel Ingalls. That is this short little novel about this housewife who falls in love with this escaped lizard man. And it's just like really sweet and really, really strange. And just bizarre. It's just sort of like this sad, lonely housewife and this lizard who really loves to eat avocados, and they fall in love. I really recommend that. It is
I love that.
Wow.
Yeah. So cool. A lizard who eats avocados.
He really loves avocados. That's actually one of weirdly my most visceral memories from that book, even though there's like a lizard man that she's having sex with. It's the avocados that really stuck with me.
Wow.
So I really recommend that. It is a bizarre read. And then the other thing that really came to mind is all the books by Katherine Heine. She wrote a collection that I absolutely love called Simple, Carefree, Mellow, and two novels so far, I think, called Standard Deviation and Early Morning Riser. And she is someone who I think, like Kevin, if you wanted to go back to using like the word like held, like, I think she's someone who, you know, puts her characters through a tremendous amount, but you always feel held by just what an utterly kind, funny presence she just is as a writer. And she, I think, like Kevin, really focuses deeply on friendships, on family, and about like kind of how, you know, grounding and important those connections are, even in really extraordinary circumstances. I never cry when I read, but she wrote this short story about this woman who has to put her dog down while she also like contemplates having an affair with the veterinarian who's going to have to put her dog down. Like it's just this bonkers story, but it's again, it's held so deftly and so sweetly that I don't know. She makes me want to be like a better writer and a more loving human. And wow. I feel like Kevin and his books do the same for me. So if you love Kevin's works, I have no doubt you'd love Catherine Heine's works. And if you love Lizard Men, you will like Mrs.
Wow, those are amazing recommendations. I don't even know how to follow up with that, but I'm going to try. I was looking through and trying to think of books that capture that weird teenage thing that's still funny, but also doesn't shy away from the dark side of what that can look like, too. And a book that came to mind, which I read a very long time ago and could tell you almost nothing about, but I remember really liking and finding very charming. And I think similarly voicey is Dear Fang with Love by Ruphy Thorpe. It came out maybe like 10-ish years ago, maybe not quite that long ago. But that was the one I wanted to recommend along with a short story collection that I just recently listened to also that came out a couple of years ago called Someone Who Will Love You in All Your Damaged Glory. It's written by Raphael Bob Waksberg, who, of course, is the BoJack Horseman creator.
Oh, yeah.
And like the weirdness of that, like there's a chapter that's just from the point of view of a dog. And those two, actually, a lot of them are about loneliness and letting people down and relationships coming to an end. But it's so wry and just utterly bizarre and inventive. They're so much fun. It's definitely one of my favorite collections that I've read in a long time. Probably since yours, Gwen.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to read that. I love BoJack Horseman, and I would love to see what he's doing in the short story.
Okay, so for our completely arbitrary rating system this time around, we thought we would do photocopies.
Okay. Okay.
So I don't know. I guess up to 100 photocopies. How many photocopies would you give this book? We'll start with you this time, Gwen.
Oh my gosh, I'm like, well, wait, how many photocopies did it take to paper the wall of that like abandoned sex and drug room?
God, that would have been perfect.
I want to rate it that number of
whatever that number. Okay, that's a perfect
whatever
number.
Whatever that number is. Yeah.
That seems extremely apt. What do you think, Angie?
Definitely at least 100 or maybe 300. Isn't 300 the number of photocopies that they made for the first time they really plastered the wall? Yeah. So
really, yeah. It's just all the photocopies.
Yes, all the photocopies that you can get before you run out of copy paper.
Exactly. Or ink, whatever happens first. Well, Angie, Gwen, thank you both so much. This was very fun.
This is wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. Thank you.
All right, that's it for Book Club this month. We have announced the next 2 months of Book Club selections on our Instagram, which you can find at nerdappodcast. But I'm going to do you a solid and tell you what they are right now, too. Our February selection is Sabrina Imbler's sciency memoir called How Far the Light Reaches. And then in March, we're going to be reading Rebecca Mackay's new book called I Have Some Questions for You, which is out in late February. We can't wait for you to read along. And of course, I think you know this, but I'm just going to say it. It is never too soon for you to send in a voice memo with your thoughts about the book. You can do that to nerdappodcast@gmail.com. The show is produced by me and Anna Bauman, and our executive producer is Brendan Banaszak.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.